The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
Well, we welcome back, of course, Professor Edwin Judge to deliver the second of his two talks on the Ten Commandments. Today's talk entitled, The Ten Commandments Sidelined by Jesus. Why did Jesus insist on the law while liberating people from it? It's wonderful to see many old faces return and also see some new this morning. Indeed, one who came along this morning, first person here, mentioned that at Sydney University. And that's not an uncommon story. We've heard that many times. The lectures that they heard so many years ago. So I think needing to read his biography, that's probably Edwin, when you come along. So we're looking forward again to another instalment. Thank you.
As the father of a daughter who worked for the Administrative Appeals Tribunal, I might suggest that our topic today is an ideal ambivalent conundrum suitable for the tribunal. In the session last week, I tried to make the point that the essence of the Ten Commandments was that they were individually personal, that is, addressed in the singular, not in the plural to Israel, but in the singular case, as it were, of the grammar to each Israeli individually. And that came out, of course, in the famous Shema, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord, our God, the Lord is one. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, and with all your soul, and with all your strength, these commandments," etc. So here was the essence of the law of Sinai, that it was personal. Hence the tremendous enthusiasm in which across 3,300 years the people of Israel had loved the law. So what is Jesus up to? I won't be spelling out the ways in which he insisted on liberating the people, as I've put it. You'll have to use your memory for that. But I want to focus particularly on the reinforcement of the commandments. As you may know, there are true dilemmas for every reader of the Gospels here, and one doesn't know which way to turn. And the best answer is, do not turn, face them both. I'm convinced the ambivalence is historically real. The marvelous profession of New Testament textual criticism loves to separate them out into the ones that are authentically from Jesus and the ones that have been written in by the gospel compilers later to soften the blows. Well, I'm not into attempting any of that, and I think very highly of the judgment and subtlety, particularly of the fourth gospel, the Gospel of John, but equally of Matthew and so on, a subtlety which led them, and remember, not just for the first time, but after years of reflection and endless debate and other treatments of Jesus, led them to juxtapose these two things, often abruptly. It does not mean that somebody's patching it together and we can cut half of it out. That is not a historically valid treatment. On the material handed out to you, the top left-hand corner of the more densely printed page is the opening of a section which in the New English Bible is headed "The Fulfillment of the Law." Jesus says, "Do not think that I've come to abolish the law." Already then, people were suspicious of him. Was he not standing up for it? I've not come to abolish them, but to fulfill them. So we must ask, what is this fulfillment? I tell you the truth, until heaven and earth disappear, not the smallest letter, not one jot or tittle, as the old translation said, not the least stroke of a pen, will by any means disappear from the law until everything is accomplished. What will be accomplished is the big question. What is Jesus fulfilling, and when will it be? Now turn to the other side of your sheet and look at the piece second from the bottom. This is written in the New Testament era, a bit later than the Gospels possibly, and by a person having no acquaintance with the Judaic history. And he's speaking of exactly the same point, cutting out one jot or tittle from the official record. If one chisels out only one word from any official tablet, you'll put him to death. This is serious talk. This is a public address before the city of Rhodes. And he's not joking. He's telling us that this level of exactitude was operative under the civil law in a Greek state of the Roman Empire. The price was death if you alter the official record. You can easily see why this may be the only record. There aren't filing cabinets or other means of storing the information. And so the official promulgation in fixed form is literally untouchable. So we need not think this kind of talk would have seemed strange to people. Jesus is invoking a well-established regard for the exactitude of the law. Well, at the end of the, go back to the other side, at the end of the Matthew passage, the first little slab, you can see that he's up against the practice of the Pharisees. The Pharisees, of course, were close to Jesus. He dined with them. He disputed with them. That's a form of closeness. He was a professional colleague or competitor with them. And in the subsequent church in Jerusalem, there was a considerable body of Pharisees who believed in him and in his resurrection. So that we don't have to treat the Pharisees as his enemies. They're his chivalrous competitors, and he's pretty tough on them. The last sentence of the first slab, I tell you that unless your righteousness exceeds that of the Pharisees and the teachers of the law, you will certainly not enter the kingdom of heaven. What on earth is this kingdom of heaven? On earth, indeed, it is the issue, isn't it? As you know from your reading of the Gospels, Jesus spoke of the kingdom not as an ultimate remote possibility laid up in heaven, even though its name is the kingdom of heaven, but it is here, he says, in the midst of you, now. And the confrontations that he has with people are often focused on entry into the kingdom. The kingdom, of course, meant for every son of Israel the national kingdom. And yet transparently it means in Jesus' teaching something both far more profound and far more immediate, because it happens now. And hence the burning conflict and desperation that surrounded the brief public life of Jesus and leading to the crucifixion. It was to get rid of the immediate threat of something drastic happening now and upsetting everything. And yet he assumes, of course, that every pious Israel, son of Israel, will mean to enter the kingdom. That was their destiny. And here's this last challenge embodied in the person of Jesus. Well, you can see on the rest of that page the adjustments to the law, the reinforcement of the law, not only insisting on it all, but making it harder than ever to keep. turn over the other side again and look at the slab of Elium written a good century or more after the New Testament, and without any knowledge of the New Testament, Elian is not working in that context. And in any case, he's quoting an opinion of Xenocrates. Xenocrates, as he says, was a companion of Plato, and he became subsequent to a generation himself the head of Plato's academy. And look what he said, according to Elian. Elian's looking back 400 years, remember, but he won't be wrong. Elian said that it made no difference whether one set one's eyes in a strange household, I think possibly is the meaning, or placed one's feet there, for the one who looks on forbidden places is guilty of the same sin as the one who goes there. It's a puzzle what exactly this scene is, but I've already hinted at my understanding of it. He's talking about the household community in which an interloper is threatening it. And I think it probably matches what Jesus says on the other page under the heading of adultery. It is the thought of the heart which condemns one, whether one actually goes to the place or not. And so it's interesting that in the Platonic tradition there is the same point. Now, look at the top of the page, the non-gospel page. I forget which page we were on when I told you a moment ago, but I'm back on the page which is heading the Book of the Community Rule. This community rule is something new to us, in the previous generation at any rate, from the Dead Sea Scrolls. And you can see yourself what remarkable thing it's saying. Do what is good and right before God. Love all the sons of light, each according to his lot in God's design. Incidentally, notice the contrast, light and darkness, very like the talk of Jesus. Indeed, in modern literary criticism of the fourth gospel, it was often thought that because of the high abstract content, talk about truth and light and so on, and word, and these various abstract ideas, that the fourth gospel was a Hellenization of the Jesus tradition. All of this was turned on its head with the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls just after the Second World War, and their slow assimilation, which is going on to this day, because they're a very complicated body of materials. They come from a couple of centuries leading up to the time of Jesus, and they are not in any determinable way directly connected with the Jesus movement. They are prior to it. But the importance of them for understanding the Gospels is that they give you a glimpse of another passionate Jewish community of his time, which talks the same way as the Gospel of John says he talked, in abstracts. And so you don't have to think of it as a Hellenic contamination of the Hebrew tradition, far from it. So there's the sons of light and the sons of darkness. But notice what they have to do. They have to hate all the sons of darkness. Now, did the old law say that? Well, it didn't exactly. It does say in Deuteronomy 23:6 that the people should not seek a treaty of friendship with the Ammonites or Moabites. This is a diplomatic and military provision, of course. But the law itself, see Leviticus 19:18 in the Old Testament, was simply, you shall love your neighbor as a man like yourself. It did not go on to say, and hate your enemy. So it's interesting that in this case, Jesus, in taking it to that point, he said, if you go back to the New Testament side, you'll see it at the bottom of the middle column. You've heard that it was said, love your neighbor and hate your enemy. That Jesus has conflated, if you like. I don't suppose he's sitting there like we are analyzing when he speaks. But in effect, he conflates the Levitical principle of loving your neighbor with its logical contradiction or counterpart, hate your enemy. But it's not there in the old code. But there it is in the precious community of the Dead Sea Scrolls, a very pure, too pure a community for its own good. And it died out. It died out hating its enemies. Not only foreign enemies, they had nothing to do with a foreign world in the caves of Qumran, but hating those who controlled the temple in Jerusalem. They were the enemies. Now, you might have said they were Jesus' enemies too, but he does not stand aside from them. He meets them, deals with them, upsets them, discusses things. He is engaged with what might have been classified in Qumran as his enemies. He would have been an enemy, in my opinion, to the covenanters of Qumran, because they were too pure and must hate. Let's go back to the hatred side of it then, and look at the very long slab from Philo. Philo is a contemporary of Jesus, a Jewish Platonist in Alexandria, and he writes about matters in Palestine. See the opening sentence, where he speaks of Palestinian Syria, about a remarkable community of which he's heard. He clearly hasn't visited them. He is an academic in a metropolitical university capital, Alexandria, and he wouldn't dream of going to outlandish places like Palestinian Syria. But he's heard of these wonderful people. They are Jews. Even though he's a Jew himself and a conscientious and serious Jewish scholar, he writes in a detached way about them, including, it is said, see the third line of the long slab, certain persons, more than 4,000 in number, called Essenes. A great debate, of course, follows the Dead Sea Scrolls. Are these the Essenes of Philo? And not only do we know about them from Philo, but also from the Roman antiquarian Pliny. The older Pliny tells us about them. So they were a well-recorded contemporary phenomenon. No one knows what the word Essenes means, as Philo himself says there. It's questionable how much Hebrew Philo knew, perhaps none. He's writing in Greek. And so he offers a typical classical etymology. You derive everything from Greek, which is certainly wrong. It's not derived from the Greek word for holiness, which is given there in the fourth line, hosiotes, at all. It's thought to be derived actually from a famous word which you'll be familiar with from the contemporary media, asad. Asad means holy. And the Syriac Assad is probably the origin of this word Essenes, not the Greek word. And the Hebrew for it is Hasidim. Now, run your eye down to the bits I've underlined, They avoid the cities. So they're in retreat from the provocative centres of community life. That means, of course, steering clear of Jerusalem. They live in villages, he said. Well, now, of course, one tends to think of the Qumran community living in caves. They must have lived in villages. They can't have lived in caves. There was room in the caves for their scrolls, but they can't grow their food there. So these are people in a rural retreat from civilization. And running your eye down that list, you'll see the extraordinary lengths to which they went. I've underlined the words moneyless and landless. So they're practicing economic radicalism too. Get rid of the financial troubles of the world by abolishing money. And get rid of disputes over property by owning no land. But quite whose land they were farming remains unstated, perhaps collective ownership. More remarkable still, see the next little bit that I've underlined, not a single slave is to be found among them, but all are free. And he goes on to say that in this three lines later, they are annulling the statute of nature. That is, this is how they denounce the owners of slaves. This is the Aristotelian doctrine that the natural order embraces the existing social order. So here are truly radical revolutionaries in their minds and in their community practice, more radical than the early churches which sprang out of Jesus' ministry. And see the last six lines. As for philosophy, they abandon logic, that's the Aristotelian principle. They abandon the physical study of the world, the atomic analysts of the Greek tradition, and retain only the ethical questions. But notice that as well as the ethics, see the third last line, they retain the philosophical treatment of two things. The existence of God, that is, the universe itself is not the divine principle, as the Greeks had said, but there is God separate from the universe. They held to this. They are true sons of Israel. And secondly, the creation of the universe. The universe was not created according to the Aristotelian doctrine. It was there always. Steady state, as we used to say 10 years ago. So, how does Jesus stand with regard to those people? Well, he's utterly unlike them. He is not living in an isolated community. He is living in the midst of the action of the day. He may have come from a provincial part of Judea, but it was a flourishing part with commercial activities, fishing, for example. He was certainly aware, as you would have to be, travelling back and forth of life on the land, but he was not off the land. He was from a tradesman's family. But above all, his sent ministry was focused upon the great city, and he was there in the midst of its turmoil. So, what are we to say about the law? Let him that is without sin cast the first stone, said Jesus, of the woman charged with adultery. Is Qumran the answer? Should the Dead Sea Scrolls be the proper matrix for explaining Jesus? Was he a failed recluse? He became the saviour of the world by turning over the tables of the money changers in the temple, by submitting to the cross, not by retreat from the world. His intensification of the law, the focusing of its meaning entirely on the inner man and what one does in private with no one watching, does not take you out of the world. It provides you the inner key to life in the contradictions of the world. I'll break off at that point, so no one stopped me. I don't know why. Where's the boss?
Now's an opportunity for you to ask any questions or comments. We do that by way of this slip. So Polly and I will pass around and collect any questions you may have for Professor Judge.
Shall I start?
I will put this one at the back.
Okay. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I'll start going on answering these questions. Do you think that the Essenes written about by Philo had any interaction with or were influenced by early Christians? Nobody, so far as I know, thinks they were influenced by the Christians. Philo doesn't give us a chronological framework, and I don't think the Essenes have to be the Dead Sea Scroll people, but many attempts have been made to explain elements of Jesus' ministry in terms of similar points in the Dead Sea Scrolls, but there's no comprehensive opinion on that matter. With regard to the Essenes of Philo, there are serious proposals that Philo has picked up the monastic movement that developed in Christianity itself in subsequent centuries. John O'Neill from Melbourne, who became professor in Edinburgh, the late John O'Neill, strongly held this view. I think it's totally wrong. I admired O'Neill, of course, he was a friend of mine. But I think it's wrong because the evidence in the monastic movement cannot be brought down so close to where it would be needed to Philo. The earliest use of the word monk, which is a Greek word meaning solitary, that we know is in the year 324. So there's a gap of 300 years. But of course, asceticism and the ascetic impulse was widespread, not just in Christianity, but not distinctive of Christianity. It was part of the classical ethical tradition. People admired, as they still do, those who live in a deliberately circumscribed, above all, celibate life. To whom does Jesus' teaching apply? Is it a universal comment on all humanity? Yes. Is it a message only for the Jews or those living in the kingdom? No. Because the promise to Israel was that through the seed of Abraham, all the world would be blessed. And I may say in historical terms, that is what has happened. The culture of the whole world today, this high technological, rights-ridden culture, is deeply embedded historically to the Hebraic tradition. And certainly the kingdom was to be universal, yet the focus of Jesus is the opposite. It's individual on the particular people he's talking to. Is Jesus' next question, is Jesus suggesting the law starts to operate before the action that it refers to? The act is unlawful, but the thought is worse. Yes, I think he is suggesting that. He's suggesting that all these things start with the inner man. This, of course, is revolutionary, because in the classical cultural tradition, the philosophical tradition, it was assumed that the inner man was rational. Alas, we still think it. That's why every social problem, we say on the media, we must have more education. No education ever takes the problem away. The educated people are just as bad as the rest. And we all know that. Next question. So in summary, in what way does Jesus fulfill the law without destroying it? Well, he fulfills it by intensifying it and individualizing it and making it, above all else, to flow from the inner man. And, of course, within the inner man is the problem. There was a beautiful book written in 1944, the last year of the war, my last year at school, called Christ's Strange Work. It was written by Alec Fidler as a lent book in wartime. And it picked up a Puritan phrase. It was the Puritans in the 17th century who distinguished between Christ's strange work, that is what he shouldn't be doing, and his proper work. It was strange in the sense of alien, not peculiar. So Christ's strange work was not what he was sent to do, according to this Puritan dichotomy. It was to reinforce the law, which of course is God's law, and of course will be fulfilled in the kingdom. It was to reinforce that, but it doesn't say it. It would save you if you could do it all. That's the New Testament position. But who dares to say that? Let him, without sin, cast the first stone. The next question. The law needs grace and truth, i.e. Jesus, to be incorporated for fullness of applicational correctness. Would you agree, Jesus being the only pure and perfect demonstrative personification of grace and truth? Yes, I think I do agree with that. But I'm not sure that I want to say much about the law that you people professionally deal with. That's a separate problem, really. I'm speaking about the law as the divine covenantal loyalty demand that was made on Sinai in the Ten Commandments, which, as you remember, are not a code of law, but a loyalty test the Lord's Prayer, which is on this sheet, says, don't put us to the test. But that's what the whole history of Israel is about, the testing of the loyalty. And that's what this concentration on the inner man is about in Jesus' teaching. He is testing for the ultimate truth within, how one personally responds, not publicly. Don't say your prayers in public, he says, on the sheet that I've given out, but say them in private where no one can see. This is the central emphasis of Jesus' teaching. It is public teaching, all right. Of course he's dealing with the legal situation, but he's overstepping it and going to the heart of the matter in life terms, to what the individual person alone before God does. Next question. What do you understand of the Jewish reaction to Jesus that he may observe the law but claimed power to change it? Is it divine power, a false prophet? Well, exactly these were the questions that confronted his contemporaries, and indeed that's what drove the movement to get rid of him, was that he was blasphemously claiming what only God could claim. The evidence is clear, of course, all through the Gospels. And I think one has to, from a historical point of view, live with the fact that is indeed what he claimed. And one has to make a difficult decision whether to say, well, he was misguided, which is in effect what the ruling authorities felt obliged to say. Yes, he was a false prophet, they said. To whom does Jesus' teaching apply? Is it a universal comment on all humanity? Have I answered that one? Have I finished them? They're a pile. I'm not sure whether I've been through them all or not. I'll say it again, just in case I say it differently. To whom does Jesus' teaching apply? Is it a universal comment on all humanity? Yes, I think it is. It is an interpretation of the essential, ultimate inner truth that everybody, so far as I know, recognizes, but which we can barely articulate and certainly can't understand. The brain scientists can't tell us why we're like this, why we know what is right, but do what we hate, as Paul said. That is the problem. Nobody before Paul had articulated it like that, but everybody except when we have to talk about education. That's the problem. Education skims over the surface of the problem, of course, and tries to tidy it up. And of course, it wasn't Paul who invented this. It was Jesus. It was his finger pointed at hypocrisy. He invented hypocrisy. The word hypocrite is an ordinary Greek word for an actor. And he said, all the righteous keeping of the law is mere acting, unless it's what in your heart you truly think. So is it a message only for Jews or those living in the kingdom? No, it's a message for all the world, and put particularly acutely for those who acknowledge the kingdom. Yes, I think I have done them all, sorry.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.